Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
It only happens once in a while, but when a quarterback gets in trouble, he has nobody to throw to, and he doesn't want to go down for the sack, he dumps the ball. It's called intentional grounding by today's rules, but where did that rule come from, and what was a game like before it existed? Timothy B. Brown of Football Archaeology joins us to tell us about the history of intentional grounding, coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history, and welcome to Tuesday. Everybody knows what this is. It is footballarchaeology.com day. Timothy P. Brown of that site is with us to talk about another piece of antiquity of the gridiron. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren. Thank you. Looking forward to giving a pass.
Or
I don't really know what I was talking about there. I just kind of was trying to make something up, but it just didn't work. So
it was a failed segue, but but I will take that pass. I'll take that pass and introduce that you have a tidbit from I believe it's a couple years old now, titled "How Intentional Grounding Came to Pass." I'm sorry, January of 2023, so a little over a year. Yeah. So, you know, a very interesting title here, Tim, and we'd love to hear more about this subject.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think I don't always come out and say it when in my writing, but I generally have some kind of broader purpose when I write a story, you know, trying to point something out. And this, to me, is an example of how when you create, you know, you come up with a new rule, something like the forward pass and making that legal in 1906, they don't always get all the rules just right. You know, they put out the rules. They think they got it. They've got, you know, the right set of rules. And then it turns out they got to change something. So then they change that. And then somebody does something else. So they change that. And so there's this kind of back and forth of rule changes until they, you know, more or less start getting it right, or at least, you know, for a while. And so this is like one of those classic examples. And I'm going to try to lay this out. I think it's clear enough in writing, but whether it's going to be clear enough speaking, you know, or talking through the issue is another story. So I'm going to try to do it. I'll do first kind of a couple of years of issues, and then I'm going to go back to the issue of, you know, what makes an incomplete pass.
Okay, fair enough.
So in 1906, that's when the pass was first legalized. And at the time, you know, you had to throw the pass. The passer had to be either 5 yards left or right of the center at the time they threw the ball. And passes thrown over the goal line were, you know, turnovers. And incomplete passes were turnovers, right? So then in 1910, they changed it. So instead of having to be 5 yards left or right of the center, you had to be 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage. And that was at the same point where the checkerboard field went away. So it changed some of the running rules for the first guy receiving the snap. And in 1910, they also made it illegal for a pass to travel more than 20 yards in the air. And they only kept that for 2 years and dropped it. So, you know, there were different things, different pressures, people trying to restrict the pass, people trying to open it up. And so they were coming up with these rules, some of which, you know, we look back on them now and they seem silly, but they were trying to adjust and adapt to what the people at the time wanted, right? So then that gets into what makes an incomplete pass. And so it's funny now looking back on it in terms of how little they anticipated. I mean, there's things that we just would consider obvious, but they just didn't anticipate certain things. So again, in 1906, you throw an incomplete pass, it's a turnover. And the opponent gets the ball at the spot of the thrown pass. So if you're 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage or 2 yards behind the line of scrimmage, that's where the opponent gets the ball. The folks who thought the pass was too restricted ended up winning that argument in 1907, so they made an incomplete pass only a 15-yard penalty rather than a turnover. And they added a thing that I wrote about recently in a tidbit that if the pass touched another player before it hit the ground, then it was treated as a fumble. It was a live ball. Anybody could go get it, right?
Now, is that only offensive players touching the ball, or if a defensive player touched it, it was also the same rule?
So a defensive lineman hit the ball and it goes,
So
tips the
even
ball.
a tipped pass that we would
Yes.
call tip pass today.
So anybody other than the quarterback touching the ball before it hits the ground, if it then hits the ground, it's effectively a fumble. That stayed in place for a couple of years, and then they made it, they kind of restricted that. But and they eventually made it an incomplete pass in 1910. An incomplete pass is just an incomplete pass, kind of as we understand it today. But they also put in a rule that if you throw an incomplete pass, so it's incomplete if it lands in bounds. If it lands out of bounds, then the defense gets the ball at the spot, so the spot where it went out of bounds. Again, seems bizarre, but that's what they did. And so for a few years, you had teams, if you had somebody who could really, arm punt the ball, if you had somebody with a strong arm who could throw the ball downfield, oftentimes they were better and more accurate than your punter. So you just give the ball to the guy, let him fire the P 40, 50 yards downfield and into the coffin corner. And the opponent got the ball wherever it crossed the line or wherever it crossed the, out of bounds. So then, at that point, you had a situation where, so an incomplete pass was just incomplete, but there wasn't any kind of requirement. Like if it was incomplete, if it landed in the field of play, there wasn't any kind of requirement that you had to have a receiver anywhere near you. And intentional grounding did not yet exist. So some of the quarterbacks got smart. And if they were being chased behind the line of scrimmage or potentially going to be tackled behind the line of scrimmage, they just threw the ball into the ground. And it was just an incomplete pass. So, it was at that point that they said, okay, this doesn't work. We need to make it so that he's actually throwing the ball to someone. So initially in 1914, they made the rule that if the quarterback is throws the ball, throws an incompletion, it's got to be somewhere in the direction of a teammate. Then later on, they said, well, it's not just a teammate, it's got to be an eligible teammate. Then another decade or two, they said, well, it's got to be an eligible teammate who actually has a chance to catch the ball. So it's just what it's a great example of how the rules kind of got more restrictive, right? And in our world, I mean, if you're anyone who's living today looks at those rules and say, well, yeah, that makes total sense. But somebody had to think those things up, and somebody had to come up with those. And And it was just in reaction to different players applying the rules to their advantage. And so they had to modify the rules, over time to have them make sense the way we think they make sense today.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting to think about the forward pass and intentional grounding in those respects, especially when you compare it to, I mean, most of us are probably familiar with what the NFL rule has probably been for the last decade, where if the quarterback gets outside the tackle box, he can dump the ball before he gets tackled. But the thing that's amazed me about that is I expected sack totals to go way down at the professional level with allowing them to do that, because you got to think, you probably have pretty close to 40 or 50% of your passes are thrown outside the tackle box. The quarterback gets outside the box, and but it doesn't seem like the sack totals are depreciating at all. They're seem either staying the same or maybe even increasing in some cases. And I think that's kind of an interesting t statistic that that those numbers still stay where they are with that newer rule.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of the explanation is just defenses are a hell of a lot more complex. They hide things, much more effectively. They play all kinds of games that people didn't, I mean, you think about a term like blitz. Well, that's if it's called a blitz, it pretty much tells you that's a post-World War II thing, right? I mean, they did some of that before, but not anywhere near, I mean, they're still doing seven-man lines, going into that period. So, it was harder to blitz if you only have like one or two linebackers or backers up, as they call them then. So, yeah, and so yeah, you have more mobile QBs. But defenses are just pretty darn good. But the thing that really points out though is, and colleges have allow intentional grounding in certain, respects. High schools still don't allow it. But it just points to, the pressure at the time was we want our best quarterbacks to stay in the game. We don't want them to be injured. We make money when we have Tom Brady in the huddle and throwing the ball. And so, that's what led to that rule. It wasn't any, there's no inherent football reason for it. It's because they want their best players to remain there on the field. It's
And
why quarterbacks, NFL teams mostly keep their starters in all game. College teams pull their studs out. NFL teams don't because they want TV watch viewers to continue watching the game.
You just think at this the 2023 season that just got done a month or two ago, and you think, the Minnesota Vikings, it was much more fun to watch them when Kirk Cousins was healthy and playing within the five or six guys that came in after him the rest of the season, or Joe Burrow going down in Cincinnati. He's much more fun to watch than some of his replacements. So yeah, I agree with what the NFL is doing, because that's what us fans love to see. We want to see offense.
So even in a losing effort, you'd rather see them out there with their best players, giving it the old college try.
Absolutely. Well, Tim, interesting subject and great explanation of these historic rules, these almost ancient rules now that seem so foreign to us. And that's what we love about football archaeology and some of these things that you share with us. Maybe you could tell the listeners how they too can partake in looking at some of these articles that you have.
Yep, just go to footballarchaeology.com. When you go there, there's going to be multiple options to sign up. You can sign up for free. There's a paid option. You can also follow me on Twitter, Threads, or on the Substack app. So whatever suits your fancy.
All right. Well, Tim, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing and doing all this research. I mean, this is fascinating stuff that not a lot of people are doing and preserving. And folks like you that are doing this, we really thank you for that and educating us. So thanks a lot, and we would love to talk to you again next week.
Okay, very good. We'll see you then.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. we invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.